And grading those portfolios has given me tremendous insight into the few things that speculators get right and the plethora of things that speculators get wrong. But most of what they get wrong comes down to three things. They aren't contrarian, which is to say they wait till a sector is in favor and hence expensive before they buy it. They need the price action to justify the narrative. The second is related to that.
Rick Rule, happy new year to you, my friend. How are you?
Andy, I'm doing very well, and the better for being on this conversation with you. Thank you for having me.
It's really my pleasure. I want to go back a little bit, just a few days ago, you gave a fantastic speech where you talked really about how investors that are willing to do the work have such an advantage, and there really is no excuse for them not to make a lot of money. And then you went, talk about that, and let's talk, work that out a little bit for me here. And from my listeners who have not heard that speech.
Well, Andy, it was an extremely aggressive speech.
It was.
And I only give aggressive speeches in markets where people are depressed. I went into the Metal Investors Forum, and there were, 400 or 500 people there who have been involved in Vancouver in junior mining stocks for, 5 years or 10 years. And as a lot, I think, they were depressed. I never do aggressive speech during bull markets because people are already too aggressive. But I was able to go into a room where people were depressed and talk to them about the fact that their own depression was a very bullish signal. Buffett famously said that you buy straw hats in winter, that you avoid competition, and the competition is on strike. So, of course, this is a wonderful time to avoid it. The theme of my talk was that if you lived in Vancouver, that you had a definable competitive advantage over other people because you had access to information and you could do the work. The truth is that you don't actually have to live in Vancouver to work on definable competitive advantage because most of your competition doesn't work. I have graded now, Andy, over 100,000 natural resource portfolios. And grading those portfolios has given me tremendous insight into the few things that speculators get right and the plethora of things that speculators get wrong. But most of what they get wrong comes down to three things. They aren't contrarian. Which is to say they wait till a sector is in favor and hence expensive before they buy it. They need the price action to justify the narrative. The second is related to that. They're fad chasers. Maybe I'm saying the same thing in number one or number two. They don't do the work. I ask investors and speculators to limit the number of speculative stocks in their portfolio to the number of hours per month that they're willing to spend studying their portfolios. I've graded thousands of portfolios with more than 50 speculative names in them. And I know that not one in 100 of those speculators spends 50 hours per month studying their stocks. And when I say studying their stocks, I don't mean watching Rick Rule videos or reading the Northern Miner. I mean reading quarterly reports, reading resource statements, reading insider filing statements, reading 43-101s or pre-feasibility studies or bankable feasibility studies. I mean working. The third thing is that most investors have a time preference, which is unrealistic. Many investors invest around a theme, say uranium or say silver or say copper, that likely has a five-year expected course. Many others speculate on exploration outcomes that might take 18 months to mature. And despite the fact that these investors are investing in identifiable and accurate narratives, they employ very short-term tactics. If you are investing in a five-year narrative and you have a three-month time frame, you're almost guaranteed to fail. The greatest part of my financial success, other than risk tolerance and being willing to work, is that I got old. And I came to understand that I needed my time expectation to conform with what was required. I needed to be able to experience compounding. Even on the speculative side, what I learned, and it actually surprised me, is that over 50 years, the speculative stocks that I enjoyed tenfold or more returns on generally required 5 years to enjoy those returns. And in almost every case during that 5 years, the share price in question fell by more than 50% at some point in time in that 5 years. So in addition to being patient, you have to be tenacious. So that was the point of that speech. The point of the speech was that we are in a period now where people hate junior resource stocks. We're in a place now where the people who are left in junior resource stocks are fad chasers. They're anti-contrarian. We're in a place now where people's investment strategy is, quote, got a hunch, bet a bunch. They aren't willing to do the work. And we're in a place now where all kinds of people who don't know anything about trading consider themselves to be traders rather than speculators. If you address those four things within your own character, there is no sector that I know of that has a better potential risk to reward than the junior miners. Let's start, though, with the headline risk. The sector itself, the whole sector, sucks. Let's get that clear. If you merge every junior miner in the world, there's probably, I don't know, 2,500, 3,000 of them, into one company, we'll call it Junior Explorco. In a very, very good year, that company, the industry, would only lose $2 billion. They'd only lose $2 billion because they couldn't raise too much more. In a bad year, they could lose $5 or $6 billion. They would call that a good year because they raised that much money. But the point of this, at the beginning of the exercise, is your listeners have to ask themselves how much money they would be prepared to invest in a company that lost $2 billion a year. Would they invest 8 times losses or 12 times losses? In a bull market, would they invest 15 times losses? When they're sick with that number, then they're ready to go. Because a subset of those companies, 5% of the issuers, maybe 10% of the issuers, generate so much value that they add legitimacy and even luster to a sector that loses $2 billion a year. The game then is to how to separate the wheat from the chaff. How to know enough that when you're the stock that you've done work on declines by 30 or 40 or 50% in price without declining in value, that rather than being shaken out and selling at a panic bottom, that you understand that the value has increased and you buy more. That's the game. And the reason that I said to the people in that audience that they had no excuse not to make $1 million or more in 5 years is because they'd taken the first step. They had invested in themselves to come to this conference in Vancouver, the epicenter of junior mining finance, and invest in themselves. For those people who were willing to do the work, who were willing to enter now, this is truly, truly, truly a spectacular time. But it's only a spectacular time if people are willing to examine themselves and examine their reaction to the risks that we just enumerated.
Okay, so I got some feedback on that and some questions here. First of all, before I give you feedback and the questions, I would really appreciate if you would list your service that you review people's portfolio. I want to do that in the middle. This is for the people that want to do the work. So as you said, how can people do that?
Anybody who wants can, for free, with no obligation, go to my website, Rural Investment Media. When you're at the website, list your natural resource stocks. Caveat, no crypto, you know, no pot stocks, no tech stocks, just natural resource stocks. And for free, I will rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. By the way, my rankings are quite harsh, so don't be discouraged. I'll also comment on individual issues if I think my comments might have some value. Since the service is absolutely free, there's, of course, a money-back guarantee. I've done a lot of these, and I really enjoy doing it. And I think it's an important place for somebody to begin their education, trying to figure out why something is a 3 or why something is a 7, trying to understand from the preponderance of poor grades or good grades what you're doing right or what you're doing wrong is a very good thing. And it's absolutely free. If you like that, and you actually want to do the work, as opposed to saying, screw it, I quit, go to the Rural Classroom, ruralclassroom.com. We've got over 200 hours of instructional programming there. Every Thursday, well, almost every Thursday, I do a live question and answer session there for free. We do information on valuation, on exploration, on people. We do live interviews with CEOs where you watch me politely interrogate CEOs. And this is absolutely positively free. In fact, you don't actually have to live in Vancouver because I live very close to Vancouver. And I pick up the phone and call people in Perth, in Sydney, in Vancouver, in Toronto, in Calgary, in London. I do some of the work for you, but you have to do the work yourself. That's Rural Classroom.
Excellent. So on all of that, and people, if all of our listeners and viewers, and there's going to be tens of thousands of people that view and listen to this, hold on, just do the work. And I'm going to give you some tips about, and my feedback to Rick about how I did the work. And then we're going to go into some specific commodities. But the feedback I'm going to give you is, yeah, do the work. And I got this from you. I am embarrassed to say it's been about, I never looked at it. I've been a junior natural resource investor, not very good, for probably 30 years. And I just in the past 5 years started looking at financial reports. So, and then I got the gumption to start calling people, the CEOs, and they actually picked up. So my question to you is, in doing the work, if you could, when you're looking at a financial report, many of your viewers are going to be intimidated by that. That means they should still do it, but they're going to be intimidated. What is just two or three things that you look for specifically in a financial report? And what's one question you would ask a CEO of a company?
The most important thing is that the CEO answers you. I made the point at the Middle Investors Forum. Many people in the audience said, well, you're Rick Rule, so you have access. And then I pointed out to them that every single exhibitor at that conference had paid $10,000 to be there that day. They want to talk to you. If they don't want to talk to you, they're telling you something very important, that they don't care about their cost of capital or their shareholders. So start with the IR person. It's their job. But get the IR person to get you in touch with, at worst, the CFO, at best, the CEO. Their willingness to talk to you is a really good indicator as to how serious they are. If they aren't willing to talk to you, they're telling you something important, which is to say that they don't value shareholders. That's a really good sell signal. Right. So, having gotten that precondition out of the way, there's two questions that are critical. The first is, that you only want to do business with serially successful people. And you only want to do business with people whose success is related to the task at hand. So say to the CEO, I have a general sense of what your company's about. Have you been successful doing this before? Have your employees, your partners, been successful doing this before? And has your board been successful doing this before? Describe your human team in the context of the task at hand. Because you want to know whether you should care about this person's portfolio, you know, this person's opinion. The second thing you do is say, tell me the most important unanswered question. Tell me what the market doesn't know about your company that if they start to know, will increase their perception and increase their share price. Andy, I've been asking this question for 40 years. And 80% of the time I answer the question, the CEO will say to me, I've never thought about it in context, which is to say that the CEO doesn't have a plan. That's good to know. That means that I can throw his company away and I can file him or her in the moron category, which is to say the next time I see them involved in something, I don't have to waste much time with them. After you have ascertained that the management team is not a coalition of butchers and bakers and candlestick makers, but in fact have been successful, that the success is related to the task at hand, you look at the unanswered question. How long will it take to get an answer? And particularly, how much money will it take to get an answer? Let's say that the CEO says that we have a surface anomaly in northern BC, golden soils, and we have some truly spectacular surface samples. But importantly, the area covered by the surface sample would be permissive for a very large deposit. We have, in addition to taking surface samples, we've trenched it. And it's obvious that the material isn't transported material, but is in fact in situ. And what we now need to do is drill it, get the third dimension so that we can begin to put tonnage and grades together. And while it's likely that it'll ultimately require 20 drill holes, we propose to drill 10 drill holes this season, and based off the information we get from this season, 10 more drill holes next season. Now, what the CEO has told you is that answering the unanswered question will take 2 drilling seasons, or a minimum of 18 months. Armed with that information, you know that this thing isn't a 6-month hold. You know that you need to be prepared to own this stock for 18 months. Mm-hmm. Now you say, sir or madam, depending on who you're talking to, how much money will it take for you to drill these 20 holes? And what other exploration expenditures will you incur? For sake of argument, it's going to be $5 million. Just so that we can have a conversation between ourselves. Sure, I get it. And how much general and administrative expense will it take to keep the company alive until I answer the unanswered question? Well, G&A, you know, listing fees, rent, salaries, that's, $2 million a year. So it's going to take $3 million in G&A and $5 million in project expenditures. That's $8 million. So you look at the balance sheet and you see that they have $1.5 million in cash. So how are you going to answer $8 million worth of questions for $1.5 million? You have to ask the CEO that. I understand. I'm really excited about the data from your surface anomaly. I like the fact that your CFO has experience in raising money, that your chairman has experience with gold exploration and First Nations relationships in Western Canada. I like the fact that you have been successful as an explorationist. I like all that. I don't like the fact that you have $8 million worth of unanswered questions and you have $1.5 million to get it done. Seems to me that you're $6.5 million short. How will you address this? That's important. When somebody says to me, I have a close relationship with Haywood. Haywood were raising money. Oh, really? Who at Haywood? I know a lot of guys at Haywood. I might be able to glean some extra information from these people who are going to give you the money. And are they going to give it to you all at once? Or are you going to raise enough money for this year's drilling campaign? And then based on the strength of that, raise more money for next year's campaign. It's important because that information will be very germane to your trading strategy. If it looks to you like the first year's drilling campaign isn't yielding good results, you can't afford to hang out for the second year, because if they raise the money for the second year, you're going to raise it at much lower prices. That's why I told the people at the Minerals Investor Forum that they had no excuse not to become a millionaire. They have the ability to be that one investor in 100 that asks the questions. They have the ability, and you do too, to develop what in my youth we called a Rolodex, you now call contacts, with people that you can call to get information, independent verification to the questions that you asked. But you have to ask them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I would just so encourage, and this is from experience, really the experience the last five or six years, of just picking up the telephone, talking to people, sometimes email, but prefer over the phone.
And then the real guys and gals want to talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have lives. They don't want to talk about hockey. They don't want to talk about politics. Some of them don't even want to talk about their families. They're so wrapped up at the task at hand that they're actually flattered that you called. And if they aren't enthusiastic, they're telling you something. You know, they're lifestyle people. And, yeah. You know, I wish them a good life, but I don't want to pay for it.
Yeah. So let's talk about some assets that, not assets specifically, but some sectors in the commodity market that we think are undervalued. On all of that, you said the word contrarian, and everybody, I find myself, when I have these conversations, everybody says that, yes, I'm a contrarian, but really few people are.
And, so true.
I think it takes a tremendous...
Marie Sinclair.
Sorry.
Actually, no, that's okay. I think it takes actually a tremendous amount of and discipline to be a contrarian. And also courage, because not so much that the market's going against you just because of the what people say are going to say to you, if you would, because you're a contrarian. And I bring this up because recently I've interviewed a few uranium companies and we've had some discussions on uranium. And I went through the comments where people were making fun of us, the speakers. That didn't bother me, but they were absolutely fed up with uranium. And I thought to myself, I even made the comment, I should have pinned it, that this looks like a bottom and we'll get all of this negative feedback. Talk to me first about how a contrarian works, especially when it's so negative. And then let's transition specifically to the uranium market, just because I think it's right now a classic example on the equity side of this.
I'm not so sure that uranium is a huge contrarian opportunity. Okay. It's an opportunity because maybe one speculator in 100 understands the structure of the uranium market. They're involved in the macro narrative, which is great, but there's elements of the market, which we'll discuss in a couple of minutes, that are critical, and people pay no attention to them, which is lovely. Being a contrarian in uranium meant that you had the courage to buy it when it was at $20 a pound, with the industry average selling, with the industry average cost being $60 a pound. That's gone. You know, we're $70 and change a pound. We attracted a lot of people to the thesis. By the way, we didn't attract them to the thesis when it was a contrarian activity. We attracted me, which is good enough for me, but a contrarian activity is when you're buying a commodity, you're buying producers or advanced explorers, developers in the sector, when the selling price of the commodity on a global basis is below the industry average cost of production. That's a contrarian. What's happened now is that the bloom has come off the rose. The froth is gone. The people who were attracted to the narrative of uranium without understanding the structure of the uranium market, although the narrative is intact, have run out of patience. There are all kinds of people on X who are posters with uranium something being part of their handle. By the way, mine is Rick Rule. Real subtle. And I noticed that, you know, uranium hummingbird, uranium moron, uranium goofball, these are parenthetic, of course. All of these people who identified themselves as uranium experts 2 years ago, after at least 6 months of study, have capitulated, which is great. That means that the hot money is gone, or at least that the hot money is going out. And it means that the premium that was built into uranium stocks that was unrealistic has exited. That's a wonderful thing. And probably the stuff that trading profits are made of, although I'm not a trader. What really appeals to me in the uranium trade, right? Well, two things appeal to me. The first is that a whole bunch of people got attracted to the sector because of data centers and AI. This is demand that'll take place 7 years from now or 8 years from now. On a net present value basis, it doesn't matter a bit. It changes sentiment, but it doesn't change demand for uranium on a net present value basis. What changes demand for uranium on a net present value basis is demothballing shutdown reactors, the pace of Japanese restarts, and Chinese new construction. That's uranium demand in 2025 or 2026. So people are selling because demand that they hoped would occur 7 years from now, 8 years from now, 9 years from now, has been called into question. I just think that's wonderful. It's difficult for me to understand just how dumb some folks are, but that's okay. The second thing is that people misunderstand the changes in the function of the uranium market. Almost every commodity on the planet, including uranium, traditionally has been priced off the spot market, which meant that you never knew as a producer how much you'd be able to sell or what you'd get paid. It's difficult to do accurate cash flow analysis if you don't understand the selling price. If you don't understand the selling price, how do you understand margin? So uranium, like every other commodity in the world, was geared to the tyranny of the spot market. I would try to construct models myself as to the fully loaded cost of production, including the cost of capital, and do copper price forecasts as an example, based off a blend of the forward strip and the total cost of production, including social rents and the cost of capital. And I got closer than people who didn't make models, but nowhere near close enough. What's changed in uranium, unlike any other commodity on the planet, is that we're progressing from a spot market to a term market. Developers and producers are able to enter into contracts, some as long as 30 years, with investment-grade counterparties, Southern Company, Duke Power, Tokyo Electric Power, China General Nuclear, that specifies within ranges the price paid and the amount sold. This certainty as to revenue eliminates a ton of risks in the space. And it also means that developers who would not be able to raise the capital to build their mines can now raise it, because they can literally take the offtake contracts to the bank as collateral, given that they're investment-grade counterparties. It doesn't mean that the developers will choose to build them. They may end up selling them to the Rio Tintos or the Cameco's of the world. 10 years ago, they would have had to have sold them. And that had an impact on pricing. If Cameco knew that they were the only logical buyer, they were disinclined to be generous. But that's changed now. And the fact that investors don't understand this, the fact that investors are more focused on nebulous demand from SMRs or data centers that haven't been proposed, haven't been financed, haven't been approved, haven't been built, and less focused on the availability of offtake with credit-grade counterparties and utilities, is really, truly silly.
Right. So you brought up a great point of spot price to term price. Is there another market that, well, I guess maybe the question is why don't other markets operate that way? And is there another market that's going to be operating that way that you could see?
The U.S. natural gas market is headed in that direction, although it's much larger.
Mm-hmm.
There are very common financial instruments in the natural gas market, volumetric production payments, some offtake agreements, long-term LNG supply agreements, so that probably 10% of the U.S. natural gas market is going to term. I believe 3 or 4 years from now, after the shakeout, that what you see in uranium is going to happen in the lithium market. It hasn't happened yet, but the coalition of interest between suppliers, including nascent suppliers, and battery manufacturers will be such that I think you're going to see tie-ups in that space that will be termed too. But for right now, it's most developed in the uranium market. It's developed because lenders who lend the nuclear power plant industry want to make sure that the utilities who build the nuclear power plants have access to enough fuel at good prices that they can amortize the loan. Let's say that Mallette Utilities is building a $10 billion reactor. And Andy has been able to attract project debt for $7 billion. You have to find $3 billion in equity, but $7 billion in debt to build this reactor. And he's obtained on contracts for a bunch of power, maybe not all of it, but some. The bank needs to be sure that Andy has contracted for enough uranium that he can pay them the $7 billion back.
Right.
And that has meant that Andy is willing to enter into a contract with Rural Resources for enough of my offtake over the period of term of the loan, let's say 15 years, that his lenders are willing to lend him the money. Mallette Utilities is, in this instance, an investment-grade counterparty, so that I can take that agreement, and I can go to my own lenders, Rural Resources lenders, to finance the construction of my uranium mine. This stability doesn't exist anywhere else. What it means is that my lenders understand not just what it'll take me to build the plant, but also what I'll receive from my product and how much of my product I can sell to an investment-grade counterparty. That makes them more willing to lend me funds, and because it de-risks it relative to any other lending category that they're invested in, it also lowers my rate. Then, beyond that, lazy old securities analysts, let's say Rick Rule, are able to do volume and pricing forecasts backed up by contracts that add much more certainty to their revenue forecasts, looking at 15 years. This is a sea change. It's an absolute sea change. And when I go to conferences and I entertain questions and answers about uranium, literally not one attendee in 1,000 brings up contracts. They bring up data centers that haven't been permitted, that haven't been financed, that won't break ground for 7 years, or small modular reactors based on technologies that don't exist, for users that don't exist. And they pay no attention whatsoever to supply agreements between Tokyo Electric Power or China General Nuclear or the Southern Company that are germane. For me, it's an absolutely wonderful set of circumstances. I'm competing with younger, smarter investors who have more time, who are more aggressive, who theoretically ought to be able to outthink a 72-year-old, but they don't show up.
So this innovation, I think we could go so many different directions with this, but this innovation from one free market capitalist to another, it seems like it was a product of free market capitalism and necessity.
It is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's unique to the uranium business because the uranium business went through such a profound bear market after Fukushima that productive capacity went to capacity heaven, even while demand for uranium ex-Fukushima stayed quite strong. So we have a market where the user is in an extremely capital-intensive business and needs to secure supply over a long term. I mean, we had just this wonderful conjunction of opportunity that we haven't seen in other commodities yet.
Well, we'll see if it happens. I'd be very interested in that. And coming from a banking sector, it seems like you would have the foresight to see what other sectors is coming into. Now, you made a comment about that uranium is no longer, and you're right with that correction of me, that uranium is no longer a contrarian play. Perhaps the equities, but uranium itself, no. But my question is, what are the commodity sectors? And I was going to ask you this a few months ago. What other commodity sectors are contrarian right now, would you say, that are just so hated? And you make this comment in the past that you love, hate.
If you would have asked me the question 8 months ago, I would have said U.S. and Canadian natural gas. In fact, I think I did on your show.
I think you did too, yes.
Those prices have really corrected to the upside. I mean, really corrected. Yeah. Natural gas for a while was free, basically, in West Texas. Now that same gas is 350, 375 a million BTU. Mm-hmm. I think it goes higher, but it's no longer a contrarian activity. What might be a contrarian activity is Canadian natural gas. The Canadian investor seems to be taking Mr. Trump seriously in terms of his tariff discussions. Without understanding that the structure of the North American energy market requires Canadian natural gas. And also without understanding that one of the great markets for Canadian natural gas will be in Europe through gas liquefaction. And because of the politics of Canada, Canadian natural gas can't travel to the Atlantic through Canada. Their prime minister believed there wasn't a business case for a commodity in demand. What that means is that U.S. transmission companies, liquefaction companies, natural gas companies, and petrochemical companies will make money transporting Canadian natural gas through U.S. facilities to Europe. Trump is not going to put a tariff on that thing, particularly given how enthusiastic the oil and gas industry was in supporting him. He's nothing if not transactional. So right now, the specter of UF tariffs is hanging over Canadian natural gas. I think it highly unlikely that tariffs on Canadian oil and gas will become a reality. The commodity that I'm probably most attracted to in a contrarian sense are rare earths. First of all, rare earths aren't rare. We need to get that straight. We haven't found them because we haven't looked for them. And we haven't looked for them because the Chinese produce them so cheaply. Two things there. The Chinese have produced them cheaply in some measure because the environmental standards employed by the Chinese in the extraction of rare earths have been, it would be charitable to say, lax, devastating. And the Chinese people and even the Chinese government have much less of a sense of humor for the environmental devastation that's occurred in Xinjiang. As a consequence of that, the cost of producing rare earths in China is going higher rapidly. Secondly, rare earths have become to be considered to be geopolitically important. The Chinese have threatened to withhold rare earths from U.S. markets, preferring to ship goods made in China with those components themselves. Because it is very likely that the price of rare earths goes up as a consequence of the fact that the cost to produce it will go up, and also because supply chains in Korea, Japan, Europe, the United States, Canada have decided that there is too much political risk around Chinese rare earths. I suspect that high-quality rare earth deposits in other parts of the world will do very well over the next 5 years. Make no mistake, the biggest ones are only marginally economic at today's rare earth prices. But I think today's rare earth prices are unsustainably low, both for geopolitical purposes, but much more importantly, for environmental purposes.
Got it. Rick, let's game some.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Man, you go ahead. You go ahead.
I think that platinum and palladium are good speculations. They're good speculations because most of the world's supply comes from South Africa and Russia, and both of those places are unstable. They're good speculations, too, because with some exceptions, probably 75% of the South African platinum industry is unprofitable at today's prices. If you had supply disruption, because the most prevalent use for platinum and palladium are auto catalysts, there's a lot of price elasticity. It takes about $100, $100 and a quarter worth of platinum to enable a sale of a $50,000 or $60,000 car. If you doubled the price of platinum, it wouldn't change the finished price of the product that the platinum goes into, the car. What that means is that if you had a nationwide strike in South Africa, or if the Russians were prosecuting a war and as a consequence of that couldn't make the sustaining capital investments in their platinum industry, that supply decrease, if any, would have an immediate impact on the market, and the increasing price of the commodity wouldn't impact demand. Is this going to happen? Is this a certainty? Not a certainty at all. Is it a possibility or a probability that's worth speculating on? Absolutely, yes.
So it's funny you say that with platinum. My son has to get his catalytic replaced as we speak. I want to say this to all of our listeners and viewers out there. You just dropped some nuggets, some huge nuggets. Number one, and I literally took 3 pages of notes here, scribbling profusely as you're talking, or writing profusely as you're talking. Really, probably the biggest takeaway I get from this is there is a great opportunity here for those that do the work. That is the cliff note of this entire talk, if you would. And then, Rick, you gave some really 3 contrarian plays, rare earths. Well, I should say potential contrarian plays. Please forgive me. Rare earth, platinum, and palladium, and plus other sectors that you're very interested in. So I want to thank you for that. Anything that you want to give our viewers and listeners, any nuggets that you have right
just
now?
Just for fun, let's do a case study.
Sure.
To put this in context.
Yeah.
Dialing myself way back to 1988, I think. Silver was just too cheap. It was really, really, really cheap. Everybody had cared about it in the 70s, and everybody was disgusted with it by the end of the 80s. And so, with a business partner of mine, Jim Blanchard, now deceased, founder of the Blanchard Conference, Jim Blanchard and I were talking over bourbon, where many good ideas originate. And he said, you know, Rick, you need to originate a really, really, really high quality, high leveraged silver product, silver company. So I cast around and I met a guy named Bob Quartermain. Quartermain was a veteran geologist who had drilled off the Hemlo deposit, one of the great gold deposits in history. I learned from my various contacts, including Ross Beattie, that he was also an honorable, honest guy. He was now in charge of a portfolio of junior mining companies that were controlled by a multinational mining company called Teck. So Teck had already vetted this guy as a geologist. He had industry-specific experience. His board of directors was chosen not because they were friends of Bob's, but because they were respected by tech. In other words, a wonderful pedigree. And one of these companies was called Silver Standard. And they had a portfolio of silver properties that went back 30 years. The market cap of this company, if my memory serves me correctly, was $1.8 million Canadian, sort of seven-tenths of nothing. And I visited with Bob Quartermain, and I said, what I'd like to do, Bob, is I'd like to finance you. I'd like to raise a couple million bucks, and I'd like you to go to all the major multinational mining companies in the world and buy their advanced silver properties. I know that these companies, if these projects wouldn't make any money under $10, think they have no net present value. I believe silver is going to go to 15. So if you could buy a 100 million ounce deposit that, say, Rio Tinto has spent $80 or $90 million on, if you could buy this 100 million ounce deposit for $3, $4, $5 million, I'd like to finance you. What I don't want you to do when silver prices is low is I don't want you to build a silver mine. I don't want you to produce a bunch of silver at 10 bucks an ounce so that when the price of silver goes to 30, you have a hole in the ground where my silver used to be. I want you to build a silver bank, a big, big, big inventory. And I did it with two guys. I did it with Ross Beaty, and I did it with Bob Quartermain. And we bought well over 1 billion ounces of silver in those days at about 5 cents an ounce.
Yeah.
I mean, just sometimes we paid up, you know, sometimes for high quality ounces, we paid a quarter or something like that. But sure enough, the silver price went up. Now, at various points in time, you know, the stock would go from, let's say in the case of Silver Standard, went from 72 cents to 250 or three, and then it fell back to a buck and a quarter. You know, it fell by half. But I believed in Bob. General administrative expense was tiny. He'd find another asset, and I'd look at the asset, and I said, we can't not buy this. We can't not buy this. So I would go to various investors and friends of mine, the Doug Caseys of the world, the Adrian Days of the world, the Jim Blanchards of the world. We'd do a private placement, you know, get some high-quality investors and subscribers in, buy the next asset, stock price would go up, that kind of thing. And then, you know, the furor engendered by that would subside. The stock price had come off. But suffice it to say, in the six-year period, the price of Silver Standard went from, if my memory is correct, 78 cents, where we did the first financing, to $45. There's a lot of lessons there.
Yeah.
Silver was genuinely out of favor. It was contrarian. The success took 5 or 6 years. There were numerous share price declines in an amount up to 50%. And there were high quality people, both in the management and in terms of the group that was backing it. You know, we never failed, never wavered in our support for Bob Quartermain. There was never a fear that the company was going to run out of money. There was never a fear, although sometimes we didn't like the price we had to issue stock at. There was never a fear that if Bob found a 60 or 70 or 100 million ounce deposit, that we wouldn't fund it. A lot of lessons there. And they're the kind of lessons, the kind of understanding that will make speculators absolute fortunes in the next 10 years.
Yeah. If you do the work.
Yep.
Yeah. We'll end on that, but I just want to say a couple of shout outs. So I've gotten to know Adrian, a friend of yours, and now a friend of mine through you. So thank you for that. He's a fantastic interview. And then the great Doug Casey, I got in touch with him, and he was fantastic, Rick. I wish I had more of his time. So many stories. And I pointed out, he has a book right there, Crisis Investing, that he signed in New Orleans in 1994 for me, and he got a kick out of that. So next time I come along, you'll probably talk to him sooner, but I'll give him your best too.
Doug may be the best interviewer of all of us if you work hard as an interviewer. One of the things about Doug Casey, he's got a very broad-ranging mind. And if you let him go on his flights of fancy, he'll talk about the significance of Rolling Stones lyrics, which is fine. But the truth is that you need to script the interview with Doug Casey. You need to keep him on track. If you keep him on track, he has a 12-cylinder brain in an 8-cylinder world. He sees things differently than other people. He's extremely valuable. And Doug Casey doesn't have to work at being contrarian. Sometimes he doesn't do it because it doesn't interest him. But if you tell Doug Casey a logical story, it doesn't challenge him at all to be a contrarian. And if you tell him, you know, this idea might not work out for 2 years, Doug will tell you, well, 78, you know, I've been through a lot of 2 year periods in my life. He's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful guy.
No, he really is. We talked about the change in Argentina.
Yep.
Because he's down in Uruguay, right across the pond, if you would, right across the, I think that's what he called it. Just right across whatever the water right there.
Rio Plata.
Yes. And then we talked, just had a great discussion about real estate. That's a huge play, Argentina real estate. So whoever wants to listen to that, I thoroughly enjoy that. And by the way, I had John Miniotis on recently, and I won't go into it. People can check out that interview. Fantastic news, what's going on with Abra Silver. So anyways, thank you for that. I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time. I'll put, we didn't get to the conference. Your conference coming up in the summertime. I'm going to be there as a media sponsor. Give us a high level, and we'll be covering it times again, but give us a high level of that real quick.
I humbly believe that this conference, after 28 or 29 or 30 years, something like that, is the single finest natural resource investment symposium on the planet. It is that for a variety of reasons. First of all, because it stood the test of time. We have a core of 200 or 300 attendees who are veterans of many markets. And it is a truism that in a conference where you have 500 live attendees and 1,000 attendees online, that not all of the knowledge in the conference emanates from the dais and goes out to the audience. In truth, there's an awful lot of experience in the audience. More experience than at any other conference in the world, with perhaps the exception of the Prospectors and Developers Conference in Toronto, which will have 30,000 people. The dais itself is important, though. We have great, great, great macro, big picture people, the kind of people who you wouldn't see on CNBC or CBC or BBC, people who tell you about the way the world is. Not the way Greta Thunberg wishes it were. People like Jim Rickards, who talk about the global financial structure because he was general counsel at Long Term Capital Management, whose failure almost brought down the financial infrastructure in the world. A guy who looked at the implications from the inside out, literally. Nomi Prins, talking about the structure of Wall Street, former Goldman Sachs partner. Guess who is best placed to talk about it. Daniela DiMartino Booth talks about the Fed because she was at the Dallas Fed. We have these big picture thinkers who were in the belly of the beast in a biblical sense, who lived it and can talk to you about it for that reason. And then we go on, after having defined a big picture view, to how to make money on it. And we do that with world-class portfolio managers who have made money in natural resources for 3 decades or 4 decades. The aforementioned Adrian Day is an example. You know, it's not like Adrian dropped into this having been a 20-something crypto analyst. He's done resources since graduating from the London School of Economics in the 1970s. After that, my favorite feature are the living legends. We assemble a panel of people who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from scratch. The Robert Friedlands of the world, the Lundin families, the Ross Beatties, the Bob Quartermains, the Sean Rosens, the Rob McEwens, the Randy Smallwoods, These people tell you how they built multi-billion dollar companies from scratch, and they talk about the investing lessons that they have learned. They teach you specifically how to identify the $5 million market cap company that could become a $5 billion market cap company, not by chasing fads, but by building multi-billion dollar durable companies over time. That feature has been so successful that this year I've added a new feature called the Investing Legends, where we bring together groups of people who have managed billions of dollars in natural resource stocks for 30 years, doing the same thing, talking about the mistakes they made, talking about what they got right, talking about their durable competitive advantage in a way that can make you a better speculator. Another thing that's really different, two things that are really different. One, at every investment conference I know of, the exhibitors are regarded as advertisers. And the qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes. Our attendees have told us that our exhibitors are content too. So if a public company exhibitor isn't owned in accounts managed by the conference sponsors, they're not allowed to come. There's no guarantee, sadly, Andy, that if I buy a stock, it goes up. But there is a guarantee that I know the company well enough that I've invested my own money in it. There is no other investment conference in the world that has that requirement for exhibition. Finally, at my conference, unlike any other conference on the planet, whether you attend live, which is what I would prefer, or via live stream from the comfort and convenience of your own home, first of all, you'll have access to the tapes, the recordings, and you'll need them. We're going to give you 48 hours of material in 4 days, and I guarantee you won't be able to take it. So rather than taking 48 hours, I'm going to take 150 hours because you're going to have access to the tapes and you're going to need it. And that access to the tapes is absolutely free. If for any reason at my conference, unlike any other conference in the world, if you don't think for any reason that I haven't earned the tuition I charge you, gold-plated money-back guarantee. Now, in however long we put the conference on, some people say 28 years, some people say 30 years. I don't have the memory to know. We've had to refund less than 0.1% of the tuitions that we've charged. But this is financially riskless. There's no other conference in the world that has enough faith in their facility that they have that money-back guarantee. And I'm sorry, Andy, I have to go. I have another call right now.
Me too.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.